Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
Today, we're plunging into a really fascinating set of notes and excerpts. They grapple with the core challenge for any country, really, how to keep its economic relationship with the rest of the world well balanced.
Right. We're talking about the balance of payments, specifically the current account.
Exactly. And the policies governments use to fix imbalances there.
Yeah, our mission today is to really unpack the toolkit governments have. You know, everything from adjusting spending and
Agricultural
taxes
policy.
to fiddling with interest rates and currency values, monetary policy,
And then the longer term stuff.
right? Making structural changes to the economy, supply side policies,
Yeah.
and even, well, controversially restricting trade.
Protectionism?
It sounds like a complex balancing act.
Oh, it definitely is. Surprisingly complex.
So why should you, listening, care about a country's current account? I mean, it sounds a bit abstract.
Well, its stability is actually crucial for economic health. It's not just numbers on a page. It affects, well, pretty much everything, doesn't it? The strength of your currency, the national debt.
Absolutely. Economic growth, a country's standing in the world, it's all connected.
And when that balance goes wrong, you feel it.
You do. A persistent deficit where you're basically buying way more from abroad than you're selling.
Importing more than exporting.
Yeah. That can pile up debt, weaken the currency over time. But, you know, running a huge, consistent surplus isn't automatically great either.
Really? Why not? Sounds like you're winning.
It can signal issues at home, like maybe people aren't consuming enough or saving excessively. And it can definitely stir up tensions with trading partners who are running deficits.
Okay, so stability is the goal. Let's figure out what's really going on here.
Sounds good.
We should start with that fundamental goal, why stability matters so much, and then maybe dissect how each type of policy works.
Yeah, look at the potential effects, the, you know, upsides, downsides.
And how policymakers try to combine them.
Okay, let's dive in. So the current account, at its heart, it's like a scorecard, right? For a nation's international transactions.
What does it track?
It tracks trade in goods and services, obviously,
Yeah.
but also income flows, like wages earned abroad or profits from foreign investments.
Uh-oh.
And also transfers, things like international aid.
And the big goal, the game, is keeping that score reasonably even over the long term.
Precisely. You don't want these massive, persistent swings, either way, deficit or surplus.
Because, let's take the deficit again. Importing way more than you export consistently. What are the real dangers there?
Well, you're spending more abroad than you're earning, essentially. Over time, that means accumulating external debt, borrowing from the rest of the world.
Which isn't sustainable forever.
No. And it can put downward pressure on your currency's value.
Making imports more expensive for everyone at home.
Exactly. And it can potentially drain your foreign exchange reserves, those rainy day funds countries hold. That can lead to instability.
But as you said, a massive ongoing surplus isn't necessarily perfect either. It seems odd.
It does, but think about it. While it means you're earning a lot internationally, it could point to underlying issues. Maybe domestic demand is weak, people aren't consuming enough,
Or saving way too much.
or saving way too much. Plus, large persistent surpluses often lead to friction, to trade tensions with countries running deficits. They might feel the surplus country isn't playing fair somehow.
Right. So governments step in. They use their macroeconomic
Yep.
tools.
These tools are designed to influence things like overall domestic demand, saving rates, investment levels.
And crucially, the value of their currency.
Exactly. All with the aim of nudging that current account back towards something resembling balance.
And the sources we're digging into today seem to categorize these tools quite neatly.
They do. You've got policies aimed at dampening expenditure, basically, reducing overall spending in the economy, then expenditure switching policies, trying to get people to buy domestic goods instead of imports.
Makes sense.
Then there are supply side policies, boosting the economy's fundamental ability to compete. Longer term stuff.
And finally, protectionism.
Protectionism, directly restricting imports. And importantly, they all work on different timescales and definitely come with tricky side effects.
Okay, let's start with fiscal policy. That's government spending and taxes. How can that fix a current account deficit?
Well, one main way is through what's called expenditure dampening, reducing overall demand.
Like hiking taxes.
Exactly. If the government increases income taxes, for example, people have less disposable income.
So they spend less overall.
Right. And part of that reduced spending usually means buying fewer imported goods.
Okay, that's one lever. What else?
The government can also cut its own spending, less spending on public projects, services, whatever.
How does that help the current account?
It reduces aggregate demand, total demand in the economy. And lower demand means lower demand for everything, including imported goods and services.
So the direct effect is shrinking the deficit by sort of suppressing the domestic appetite for imports?
Precisely. It tackles the demand side of the imbalance.
But wait, can fiscal policy also work on the other side? Not just reducing demand, but maybe helping us sell more stuff abroad, the supply side?
Absolutely. And this is where the sources point to another, often longer-term, role for fiscal policy.
How so?
Think about government investment. Spending on infrastructure, better roads, ports, high-speed internet,
okay,
or investing in education, training, technology, these things can make a country's businesses more productive.
I see. More efficient.
More efficient, more innovative, more internationally competitive.
Better infrastructure makes it cheaper and faster to export goods.
Right. And a more skilled workforce can produce higher quality, more desirable products.
So this kind of public investment encourages growth, particularly in export-oriented industries.
Exactly. So while dampening demand might offer a quicker fix for a deficit,
using taxes or spending cuts,
fiscal policy, through strategic investment, can also help reduce deficits over the long haul by making the entire economy fundamentally better at competing on the global stage.
Okay, that makes sense. Two sides to fiscal policy. Now, switching gears. Monetary policy.
Right. Central banks.
Yeah.
Mostly influencing interest rates and, through that, exchange rates.
So what happens if the central bank hikes interest rates?
Right.
To fight inflation, maybe, or cool the economy?
Well, higher interest rates generally tend to attract foreign capital, investors seeking better returns on their money.
Money flows into the country.
That inflow increases demand for the domestic currency.
Pushing its value up. Appreciation.
Exactly. But the currency strengthens.
Okay. But wait. If our currency gets stronger, doesn't that make imports cheaper for us?
It does.
And our exports become more expensive for people in other countries.
That's right.
So, hang on. Wouldn't that potentially make a current account deficit worse? Or at least shrink a surplus?
It certainly can, especially in the short term. It makes those imported goods seem like a better deal domestically, while making it tougher for your exporters to compete on price internationally. So, yes, higher rates can sometimes worsen a deficit initially.
Okay, so what about the opposite, lowering interest rates?
Lowering rates tends to make holding the currency less attractive for foreign investors.
Yeah.
Capital might flow out.
Weakening the currency. Depreciation.
Yes. And a weaker currency makes your exports cheaper for foreigners to buy.
Increasing demand for them, hopefully.
And makes imports more expensive for people at home.
Discouraging import spending.
Exactly. So that shift in relative prices helps improve a deficit or reduce a surplus.
Now, here's where I think it gets really interesting. Sometimes policymakers try to directly influence the exchange rate itself, right? Like allowing or even engineering a currency depreciation or devaluation.
Yes, that's a major tool they might consider.
And the basic idea seems simple. Make your stuff cheaper for foreigners to buy and make their stuff more expensive for your own people. Should fix the trade gap.
Intuitively, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But this is fascinating. It's not always a guaranteed quick win.
Ah, why not?
The sources we looked at bring up something crucial called the Marshall or Lerner condition.
Marshall Lerner. Okay, what's that?
It basically states that a currency depreciation will only succeed in improving the current account balance if, and this is the key part, if the combined price elasticity of demand for your exports and your imports is greater than one.
Whoa, okay. Price elasticity. Remind me, that's how much the quantity demanded changes when the price changes.
Exactly. How responsive demand is to price changes.
So let's break that down. If your currency weakens, your exports get cheaper abroad.
Right.
If foreign demand for your exports is elastic, meaning they buy a lot more just because the price dropped a bit, that's good for your trade balance.
Very good. Volume increase outweighs the price decrease.
Okay. At the same time, imports become more expensive at home.
Mm-hmm.
If domestic demand for imports is also elastic, meaning people at home cut back and buy a lot less because they're suddenly pricier, that also helps the trade balance.
Correct. You're spending less foreign currency on imports.
So the Marshall-Lerner condition says you need enough of this price sensitivity, this elasticity on both sides for exports and imports combined for the depreciation trick to actually work and improve the overall balance.
Precisely. The sum of those two elasticities needs to be greater than one.
And if demand isn't very elastic, what if foreigners keep buying roughly the same amount of your stuff, even when it's cheaper? Maybe it's unique. or essential.
Or if people at home keep buying roughly the same amount of imported goods even when they cost more, maybe there aren't good domestic substitutes.
Right. Then depreciating your currency won't actually fix the trade balance. You might just end up selling cheaper exports and paying more for the same imports.
Exactly. The volume changes aren't enough to offset the price changes in the right way.
That's already complicated. But there's more, isn't there? Something called the J curve?
Ah, yes. The G curve effect. This is another really surprising twist.
What happens?
It suggests that right after a currency depreciation, the current account balance might actually get worse before it gets better.
Wait, worse? How? The whole point was to improve it.
I know, it seems completely backwards. But think about the immediate aftermath. In the very short term, trade volumes often don't change much.
Why not?
Well, existing import and export contracts are already in place. It takes time for consumers and businesses to find new suppliers, adjust their buying habits. Inertia.
Okay, so volumes stay roughly the same initially.
But the value of those imports, measured in your now weaker domestic currency, suddenly goes up. You're paying more for the same stuff, effectively.
Ah, because the exchange rate changed instantly, but buying patterns didn't.
Right. And your export volumes haven't had time to pick up yet in response to the lower prices abroad. So the initial impact is that your import bill rises in domestic currency terms, while export earnings haven't caught up. The deficit widens.
It gets worse.
Then, over time, as those trade volumes finally start to respond to the new relative prices, your exports gradually increase, your imports gradually decrease.
The current account starts to improve.
Exactly. It traces out that characteristic J shape. If you plot the balance over time, down first, then up.
Wow. So the cure itself can make the patient look sicker at first? That must be a really tough political sell for policymakers trying to use depreciation.
Absolutely. Imagine explaining that. We weakened the currency to fix the deficit, and now the deficit is bigger. But just wait.
Yeah, tricky. Okay, so summarizing monetary policy. Using interest rates and exchange rates is a key tool, especially useful for demand-side imbalances, but comes with these really important caveats, the Marshall-Lerner condition, and that potentially painful J-curve effect.
Well put. Okay, moving on from demand management and price adjustments, let's talk supply-side policies.
Right. These aren't about immediate fixes, are they? More about the long game.
Exactly. They're about fundamentally improving the structure, the efficiency, the competitiveness of the economy itself, making it better at producing things the world wants to buy.
Like the fiscal spending on education and infrastructure we touched on earlier. Is that part of it?
That's definitely a big part of it. But it's broader, too. The sources mention things like deregulation.
Reducing red tape for businesses.
Yeah, cutting business costs, making it easier to operate. Also, labor market reforms aiming to improve flexibility, skills, productivity.
Okay, what else?
Providing incentives for research and development R&D. Fostering innovation so companies create new and better products.
To stay ahead of the curve globally.
Right. Or even offering targeted tax relief or subsidies to strategically important export industries, giving them a specific boost.
And the overall impact of all this, if you make your industries more efficient, more innovative,
their production costs might fall, the quality of their goods and services could improve,
which makes them more attractive to foreign buyers, boosting export performance.
Yeah, directly. It can also reduce reliance on imports because domestically produced goods become more competitive compared to foreign ones.
Ah, substitution effect.
Mm-hmm. And a more competitive, efficient economy can also attract more foreign direct investment FDI.
Foreign companies setting up shop.
Yes, which often brings in capital, technology, expertise, and can further support export capabilities down the line.
The big catch here, though, is the time frame, isn't it?
Absolutely. These are not overnight solutions. You don't reform an education system or see the results of R&D incentives in a few months.
It takes years, maybe even decades, for the full effects to materialize.
Right. But the potential payoff is a more sustainable structural correction to current account imbalances, rather than just papering over the cracks.
Okay, so fiscal, monetary, supply side. That leaves one more category. Protectionism?
Yes, the controversial one. These are direct government actions specifically designed to restrict imports.
To give domestic industries an advantage over foreign competitors.
Exactly. And the tools are quite blunt.
Like tariffs. Putting taxes on imported goods.
Tariffs are the classic example. Makes imports more expensive for domestic consumers and businesses.
What else falls under protectionism?
Import quotas, strict limits on the actual quantity, the volume, of certain goods allowed into the country.
So you just can't bring in more than a certain amount.
Right. Governments can also use subsidies, but specifically subsidies targeted at domestic producers to help them compete against imports.
Financial support.
And then there are administrative barriers, sometimes called non-tariff barriers.
What are those like?
The complex regulations, specific standards that are hard for foreign firms to meet, excessive paperwork, customs delays. Basically, bureaucratic hurdles designed to discourage imports.
Okay, the purpose seems pretty straightforward. Cut down the amount of imports coming in?
Yes. Reduce the volume or value of imports, which arithmetically improves the trade balance component of the current account.
They're also often used to shield specific domestic industries, right? Sometimes called infant industries that are just starting out.
Yes, or sometimes older industries that are struggling to compete, maybe to try and protect jobs in those sectors.
So what are the upsides? Do they work?
Well, in the very short term, they can lead to a quick improvement in the trade balance, simply by blocking or reducing imports. That part's undeniable.
And they might provide temporary relief, a lifeline, for those domestic industries that are facing intense foreign competition.
True. But, and it's a big but, the sources we've reviewed are really clear about the significant drawbacks and the long-term risks associated with protectionism.
Okay, let's hear them. What's the downside?
A major danger, perhaps the biggest, is retaliation. If you put tariffs on another country's goods, they're very likely to slap tariffs right back on yours.
Leading to trade disputes or even trade wars.
Exactly. Where tariffs escalate, trade shrinks, and pretty much everyone ends up worse off economically.
What about the effect at home?
Protectionism inevitably increases prices for domestic consumers. If you block cheaper imports, people have to buy a more expensive domestic alternative or just pay the tariff on the import.
And it reduces choice in the market.
Reduces choice, absolutely. And there's another long-term risk by shielding domestic companies from the harsh realities of international competition.
You might be protecting inefficient industries.
Precisely. It reduces the pressure on them to innovate, to become more productive. It can actually stifle dynamism and productivity growth across the economy in the long run.
So it sounds like while protectionism might offer a fast, maybe politically appealing fix for a deficit,
it often comes at the cost of reducing overall economic welfare, damaging international relations, and potentially hindering long-term competitiveness. It's generally seen as a high-risk strategy, especially if used heavily or for long periods.
Okay, so we've got this whole menu of options. Hitting demand with fiscal or monetary policy, changing relative prices via the exchange rate, building long-term capacity with supply-side reforms, or directly blocking trade with protectionism. How do policymakers actually decide what to do? What makes these policies effective in the real world?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? The sources highlight several critical factors that influence effectiveness.
We already talked about elasticity, right? That Marshall-Lerner condition. How responsive trade flows are to price changes from currency shifts or tariffs.
Exactly. That's fundamental. If elasticity is low, depreciation or tariffs won't do much to the trade balance.
What else matters?
Global economic conditions are huge. Are your main trading partners experiencing strong economic growth, so they're eager to buy your exports, or are they in recession?
Makes sense. You can't export easily if nobody's buying.
Right. The country's exchange rate regime also matters. Is the currency freely floating, determined by market forces, or is it fixed or managed by the government?
That affects how much control the central bank has over the exchange rate as a policy tool.
Definitely. And then there are those time lags we discussed.
Like the J curve. Policies don't work instantly.
No, they take time to bite. And those delays can be unpredictable, making it hard to calibrate the policy response correctly.
What about politics?
Oh, huge factor. Political feasibility. Can a government realistically implement policies that might be painful in the short term, like significant tax hikes or unpopular spending cuts?
Or politically sensitive reforms, like changing labor laws.
Exactly. And finally, international obligations play a big role, especially regarding protectionism.
Like World Trade Organization rules.
Precisely. WTO rules limit the extent to which countries can use tariffs, quotas, and discriminatory subsidies. You can't just throw up barriers arbitrarily without consequences.
Okay. So, given all that complexity, the different tools, the side effects, the lags, the politics, the global situation, is there any kind of general consensus emerging from the material on the best approach? Or is it just always context specific?
Well, it's always somewhat context specific, but the sources do suggest a general direction. Typically, a durable solution seems to involve a combination of policies.
Not relying on just one thing.
Right. Relying solely on demand-side tools, just squeezing domestic demand, usually provides only temporary relief and can harm growth.
Okay.
A better mix often involves using some demand-side policies, fiscal or monetary, to manage the immediate pressures of a large imbalance.
While simultaneously implementing those crucial supply-side policies.
Exactly. Focusing on structural reforms that boost competitiveness over the long term. That combination is often seen as the most sustainable path.
And where does protectionism fit in that best approach?
It's generally viewed with caution. Maybe as a very temporary measure in specific circumstances, but relying on it heavily as the primary tool is widely seen as risky due to all those drawbacks we discussed, retaliation, higher prices, inefficiency.
So avoid it if you can, basically. Focus on competitiveness.
That seems to be the prevailing wisdom in the material we looked at.
Okay, let's try and sum this all up then. Correcting these current account imbalances. It's clearly far from simple.
Definitely not. It requires governments to skillfully manage both demand and supply using fiscal and monetary levers.
Commit to those often difficult long-term structural improvements through supply-side policies.
And navigate the very tricky, often risky path of protectionism, usually trying to avoid it as a primary strategy.
And the ultimate goal isn't just about hitting a specific number on the balance sheet, is it?
No, not at all. It's about finding a balance that supports sustainable economic growth, stability, and prosperity for the country in the long run.
And understanding these policies, even at this level, helps you, the listener, see the really intricate ways governments try to manage their country's position in the global economy.
Yeah, it's not just abstract economics. It has real-world consequences.
It impacts the cost of imported goods you buy, the competitiveness of industries where people work, the strength of the currency in your pocket, and the overall resilience of the national economy.
Absolutely. And considering all these competing tools, you know, the potential side effects we talked about, the time lags, the unpredictable global backdrop, the domestic political pressures, how incredibly challenging must it be for policymakers to choose the right mix?
Yeah, it really makes you think.
It raises an important question, perhaps for you to ponder. What combination of these policies do you think is truly the most effective and sustainable in today's deeply interconnected world?